The Upper Cumberland is filled with rich history that helped to shape our country to what we live in today. Join Abbott historian Troy Smith as he will tell you tales of characters and events that happened in your backyard. Mountain True starts now.
Hello, my name is Troy Smith. I'm an associate professor of history at Tennessee Tech. And this is Mountain True, where we talk about local Upper Cumberland history, and specifically looking at ways in which the things that have happened here have been connected to the bigger picture nationally. And today, we're going to look at a practically forgotten incident way back in 1947 in Sparta, Tennessee, which was a strike at the Milan Manufacturing Company, later known as the Sparta Shirt Factory. Previously, I talked some about the United Mine Workers and their efforts to organize throughout the South and Southern Appalachia and in the Upper Cumberland, how that was kind of slowed down by events that had taken place in the 1920s and then again in the 30s with the strike at Wilder. But now we're going to see how that connects in to the stuff that happened at the shirt factory. But first, just to kind of set the stage, we have to bear in mind the time period we're talking about. This all starts actually 1946, actually starts in 1945, right after the end of World War II. So lots of young men were returning home after having been away for a long time. And that's obviously going to affect the labor market. It did affect the labor market nationally. And it's going to have an effect in Sparta. Now, another thing that we're going to have to look at before we sort of zoom in on the micro level is something that was happening throughout the South that involved not just United Mine Workers, but the American Federation of Labor, which they were a part of, the AFL, and also the CIO. They hadn't joined together yet. That would be a few years. But these were two large labor organizations that each, independently at the time, was making a push to organize and try to unionize in the South. Now, most of the labor unions in the country were in the other parts of the country. It had never really taken hold in a big way in the South. And this was becoming problematic for these labor organizations because, well, there were, in all these southern states where there were practically no unions, politicians were not feeling any pressure to address the issues of workers or labor issues. So the hope was get more unions in the South and put more pressure on Southern politicians and then nationally try to improve the situation. There was a name for this. It was called Operation Dixie. And throughout 1946 and 47 and into 48, there were union organizers coming down to the South from other parts of the country to try to, as one person put it, unionize everything in sight. Or at least try to. In some cases, there were people who had been involved in United Mine Workers in the South in those efforts to organize in the coal mines who were still operating, who were in the South and sort of not only didn't have far to go to participate in this, but you knew the culture. And so a couple of those individuals were sent to Sparta to work on trying to organize at the local shirt factory. I want to point out now that we're talking about events that happened 70-plus years ago. There are still some people alive who were a part of this, and certainly, if not people who directly participated, children and grandchildren. So what I'm going to do in this discussion is I'm going to avoid using a lot of names other than the principal players who showed up in the newspaper a lot. So one name that I am going to use is one of those two organizers that was sent. Member of the United Mine Workers, his name was Silas Huddleston. And he had a very long association with UMW. He and his partner came and met with the people that worked at the shirt factory and worked on trying to organize a union, to set up the means to have a vote taken among the workers as to whether they wanted to unionize. And the first step was to appoint officers, or to elect rather officers for this union in the shirt factory. And so they did that. Some people stepped forward and took on those roles. And there was a meeting in 1945 in the spring in which Huddleston and at least one other organizer met with several of the people who were primarily taking leadership roles and trying to unionize the shirt factory. Several of them were women, a large percentage of the workers, which the number of workers there is, number of workers there varied from year to year, from 500 to 700 during that time period. Now, let's step back for a moment and take a look at the factory and its place in the community. The owner of the factory had been, well, he'd been trying to get local businessmen, including people who were in the Chamber of Commerce, which had just recently been formed in Sparta, and the mayor, to participate in putting together a building committee to raise funds to build houses, because he said that part of the reason he couldn't get enough workers was that there wasn't enough housing in Sparta, enough adequate housing, and that if more homes were built, then more workers would be attracted, because a lot of people who lived in near Sparta were working in other surrounding towns, even though Sparta was closer, because of the housing situation. They were able to move there. He also built an addition to the factory, a kind of a separate business that was really part of the overall business. It was a box factory. So in the factory, they were making dress shirts and later pajamas, I think. And then they were also manufacturing the boxes to ship these things in. This was a big investment for a lot of people in the town. There was also some ill feeling toward unions as a result of what had happened in the 1930s, not just in Wilder, in that very violent strike that we talked about, but in White County there were strikes, and eventually several of the mines closed down. Rather than recognize unions, allow them to be unionized. So there was a feeling that bringing in more unions would endanger the jobs that were there. And on the other hand, there was a lot of feeling from workers, not just at the factory, that they were being taken advantage of, they weren't being paid well enough. There were complaints about the working conditions at the factory. Just one example of problems with working conditions is they didn't have a break room at that time. So the workers, and again, most of them were women from White County, the workers, when they took their lunch break, had to go sit outside and eat their lunch. And if it was raining, they had to eat their lunch in the public restroom. So that's just one of many things they were complaining about. Well, when the UMW organizers were meeting with these folks, they got their list of officers together. The Huddleston and his partner left, saying they were going to return soon, and they never showed back up. Turns out Huddleston was arrested and transported out of the county. He was actually taken to Cumberland County and then put out of the sheriff's, the deputy's car, and told not to come back to White County. So nothing much happened for a while after that, until a few months later when a complaint was made to the National Labor Relations Board, the NLRB, complaint that the owners of the factory, sort of supported by some of the members of the Chamber of Commerce, had intimidated the workers to prevent them from unionizing. Now, in addition to the mine workers guy being taken out of the county, several people were fired, either fired or their hours were cut to the point that they weren't able to keep working. And these were all the people who were sort of the leaders of the movement to organize. So the NLRB comes with these charges, and they have hearings at the courthouse in the Sparta Square, hearings that, according to the newspaper, hundreds of people were trying to squeeze in and were thronging about in the square outside wanting to know how this was going to turn out. Ultimately, the ruling came back that the factory owner and the businessmen were in fact guilty of the charge of intimidating the workers to prevent them from organizing. Eventually, the charges, well, on appeal, the thing eventually went away, but at least initially, it was seemed like a victory for the people who wanted to organize. So they took another opportunity, another try in 1946. They took a vote. They got to take an actual vote, and it fell short, and so there was no union. And the next year, they tried again. Now, meanwhile, this Operation Dixie was in full swing, and there were union organizing activities taking place, not just at the shirt factory, but in several businesses in White County and in surrounding counties throughout the Upper Cumberland. Finally, in the summer of 1947, actually late summer, September, there was a walkout staged by some of the workers at the factory, and then a vote was taken, and this time 90% of the workers signed on to the union. They were asking at this point for better working conditions, a raise, and for their union to be recognized. Well, it was a tense time because the owners just did not approve of the very idea of allowing a union. There were, well, the community was divided. Some people supporting the workers in this case, and then other people, harking back to what I was talking about earlier, kind of being scared that what had happened with the coal mines would happen and the factory would shut down and move elsewhere. The newspaper was regularly carrying letters from citizens and editorials by the people at the paper that stated some very strong opinions about what was going on. Eventually, this involved more than stating strong opinions. On one occasion, a scuffle broke out between the striking workers and the small number of workers who initially were continuing to work. Eventually, the factory was shut down and didn't open back up until January. So almost 4 months this went on. But there was a scuffle called in the newspaper, a quote, a hair-pulling affair that involved several of the women, as well as a thumping, according to the paper, in which the people who were still working were sort of, well, again, scuffling with the people who were on the picket line. Six people were arrested as a result of this. Later on, there was an even bigger confrontation. It started when word had gotten out that the then president of the Chamber of Commerce had made some very assertive statements, some very negative statements about the union, and over 100 really angry, striking Sparta women marched down Shirt Factory Hill, as it's still called there today, marched down to the square, whereupon they sort of moved through several local businesses whose owners were members of the Chamber of Commerce and essentially beat the crap out of several of them. Well, they chased one female employee out of a sandwich shop and closed down the shop. They beat up one of the chamber members, broke his glasses and blacked his eye. They beat up another local business owner, and in this case, it doesn't come right out and say so in the newspaper reports. It said that negative things were said about his religion, that a religion that he shared with the factory owner. So essentially, these two businessmen were Jewish, and so there was some ugly anti-Semitism going on. In addition to these really angry ladies just whomping on these businessmen. According to the paper, quote, police were impotent before the crowd, and I bet they were too. I can't even imagine, because you know, when I was a kid, I knew some of these ladies that were older by that time, and so you get about 100 of them together and stir them all up, it would have been a bad scene, and indeed it was. Several of them were arrested, although the charges were later dropped. Also, in the newspaper, there were complaints by some local people that some of the men who were on strike were wearing their military uniforms, thinking that, striking is a communist, un-American thing to do, so they shouldn't be wearing their uniform. Well, you know, the other side of the equation was, the other argument was that, a labor activity is an American right, and it's what they had fought for in those uniforms. Eventually, there were calls for them to be arrested for wearing their uniforms, and that never happened. However, one of the UMW organizers who was there, sort of spearheading this whole thing, was arrested for carrying a handgun. Then there was another scuffle. Some more people were arrested for fighting. Two men were arrested for, quote, blackguarding and using bad language. It was a pretty tense situation. Eventually, an agreement was reached, and the factory opened back up in January. The workers came back with a 10% raise, and life then continued as normal. The Operation Dixie kind of fell apart. It didn't get very far, in a large part because they were working against the culture, the regional tradition of not supporting unions. Also, an issue that they ran into, not so much in the Upper Cumberland but other places, was because of the Jim Crow laws. It was difficult to get the white and black workers in a situation where they could work together on these types of things. So anyway, all that was connected in a lot of ways back to the coal mining things, because it wasn't just a labor issue, but it was United Mine Workers operatives who were involved in both cases. And that's where we now will be able to take that kind of obscure 1947 event in Sparta and tie it to something national, something that happened much later. So we're going to go forward in time more than two decades. We're going to go to 1969. The president of the United Mine Workers at that time and for a long time had been Tony Boyle. He had an opponent in the election for keeping his role as president. His opponent was a guy named Jock Yablonski, who lived in Pennsylvania. And Yablonski was a reform candidate. He was running in opposition to long-serving President Tony Boyle, claiming that Boyle was corrupt and that he was closely connected with several mob figures. An election was held, and Boyle managed to win, but Yablonski claimed that that there was some corruption involved here in how the election was carried out. And he swore out, or he was going to, said he was going to swear out a complaint about that. Now, the UMW president, it turns out, had a meeting with several of his high-level officials. Let's track that last sentence. Turns out Tony Boyle had a meeting with several of his operatives, including a guy who was in high up in the regional UMW in Tennessee. And it was pretty much decided at this meeting that Jock Yablonski had to die. Well, was Tony Boyle extremely corrupt and connected to the mob? The fact that he decided to kill the person who said he was might give us some indication, right? What does all this have to do with Sparta? Well, they were trying to decide who was going to do it. And the guy who was there from Tennessee said, if nobody else will do it, I know somebody that will do it. And that somebody was Silas Huddleston, the very same individual who had organized the Sparta shirt factory strike in Sparta back in 1947. There had been rumors that throughout his career, Huddleston had been involved in a lot of altercations. Apparently, back in the 1940s, as the UMW was trying to organize shirt factories throughout the South, other unions were trying to do the same thing, and sometimes this led to fist fights, beatings. One guy was from another union was actually shot, but I think it was a date book or something that he had in his coat kept him from being killed. So anyway, Silas Huddleston had been involved in, as some people might say, some hinky stuff for a long time. And sure enough, he was willing to be involved in this. He did not travel to Pennsylvania personally. He was retired. What he did was he got his son-in-law to take charge of the actual assassination of Jock Yablonski. His son-in-law picked up another couple of guys, and they did. They went up to Pennsylvania, and late one night they went to Jock Yablonski's house while he was sleeping, and killed him and his wife and his daughter while they were sleeping in their beds. And turns out they left a beer can in the snow outside the house with their fingerprints on it, from which the FBI was able to track them down, find out, follow sort of the chain, and find out ultimately that this had been ordered by Tony Boyle. The actual assassins wound up with the death penalty. Tony Boyle was sentenced to life in prison. The guy who had volunteered, Silas Huddleston, the other Tennessee guy, he got consecutive life sentences. Huddleston and his daughter turned state's evidence and were put into witness protection. So, no one knows where they wound up or what happened to them. At that time, by the way, Huddleston was living in La Follette. I read through the report of the FBI agents who did the investigation, and they were talking about how unusual it was for them. I mean, they were FBI agents in the 1970s. to go around asking questions about somebody and having guns pulled on them continually. On one occasion, the FBI agent had to disarm a coal miner in the mines that he had gone to talk to. So anyway, that's a very sordid story. Obviously, got this whole family killed in their sleep. But it is a very interesting connection, a series of connected events that can be traced back through the decades to various labor activities that happened right here in the Upper Cumberland. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Mountain True. Download your favorites and keep up with new episodes in the Henson Oakley Podcast Center.